we've got the time now to see our world and the struggles that surround us. I believe there's a force for good and it's coming. And tell me, what about the peace? There's an energy and it's rising from the rooftops. A call for change where we're all bathed in sunlight. The justice for the few.
Listening to Phoenix 98 FM, and that was Peter A. Noon and Crossroads, Clouds and Me. Hello, Peter. How are we today?
I'm very good.
So we're going to have a to you about lots of things. I mean, Crossroads, Clouds and Me, we've just heard. That's on our A-list. The listeners will have heard that quite a lot on the station and everything. We love that song here. What can you tell us about that single to start off with?
Well, that single, musically, how it started is my friend, John Moss, the drummer, wanted to take back his keyboard for his son. And I went, okay, so I just went up and started recording and got the synth parts of the sequence, I got that shape of a song. And then I wrote a song around it. And what was inspiring for me was Glastonbury 2019, where I was suddenly on my own. And then suddenly I found myself watching Years and Years. And in between Years and Years and Kylie comes on some geezer called Sir David Attenborough. And he was, well, first of all, he was actually saying, brilliant that it's gone plastic free. As I looked around and seen so much plastic everywhere on the floor, but that was our fault, not his. And what he was saying from that moment, and that became the inspiration of the song, that I wanted to write a song about positively, about what could be done, or what we, not to be kind of victims of this global thing where we don't have an impact, that we could actually say something and do something about it individually. And mine was a song. And that's how it came to be, as writing a protest song for the environment, really. That's what I do.
You've mentioned the Heat. I mean, it's key right now that
we
need to be thinking about it. You've got the far right press coming out and saying that everyone's being snowflakes about the temperature and everything, and trying to convince people there isn't a problem. So we need voices like yours and Attenborough, obviously, as inspirational as he is, and people like you taking that and actually making sure that that voice is being heard through other mediums. So, thank you for that then. So, right, just before we came on air, I said this to you, that I'm going to call out, you are not an ex Herman's Hermit. You're not a number. You are your own man. So hence the Peter A. Noon, as I understand. I mean, you've been in the music industry a long time. I think it's safe to say you're a celebrated session musician. You've played with huge names. I mean, why is it taking you so long to release music under your own name?
Because for many years, I was happily writing within situations in bands. As far as back as The Cross with Roger Taylor of Queen, I was writing and one of the key writers, and you'll see my names on lots of songs on that initial. We did 3 hours together. But I was never super confident about my voice, and I was always in bands with some great singers. So it came from an era where I was happy to be a bass player, guitarist, writer, but not to be the lead singer. But over the years, thinking, oh, I'm always waiting for a lead singer to come along to do my projects, I thought, I'm just going to do mine. And in 2014, I released an album under the name Shadow Boy, which was just very much, I sung on one of them, but it's very much a dance album. But what I wanted, we're using real instruments as much as program stuff. But then I suddenly went, because this album is going to start off as a Shadow Boy album. And then the more I played on it, I went, I'm going to do a whole album of me singing, me writing tunes. And that is why it's taken that long, because it's a strange thing that I suddenly felt I'm feeling more ambitious and more confident now than I did 20 years ago, that I feel this is my time. I want to do it. And I would regret it if I didn't. So that part of it was hurry up and, stop waiting, just do it. So my thing was, I want to do it. And lockdown came and I thought, I'm just going to go into it even more and just get it mostly done and write. Because it really has been, apart from my brother getting involved mixing and adding some parts, I was literally on my own doing everything. I'd program it. I had some great drum samples given to me by John Moss so I could use his. But I would literally write a song or a tune. I would lay the drums, do bass, do keyboards, start editing, reevaluate the song, rearrange the song, and then so it was very much a slow process. You know, like Paul McCartney can do a lockdown album and call it in Rockdown, but he's got his own engineer, he's got this. But I was just doing everything, so that's why it's taken me so long.
It sounds like a proper labour of love.
It is a labour of love.
Excellent. You were brought up in Harlow, and that's where your musical journey started. I mean, Harlow, I remember the Square used to be there. That was a famous...
That's my first gig.
Your first gig at the Square. Yeah, it was a sad day when that was... tell me about the music scene of growing up in Harlow.
Well, I mean, I grew up in a very secure Irish family, and I was doing sports up to 16, but as soon as the music thing took over, I didn't start playing till late, so I didn't get and I chose to be a bass player because my brother's a guitar player, and I didn't get a bass till my 15th birthday. But I'd fallen in love with music, and from that moment on, we were starting. By just before 16, I was gigging at the Square, the very first gig. And what we walked into was a scene where there was at least 40 or 50 bands, and suddenly venues were opening up. And there was this great guy who worked. He was the entertainment officer for Harlow Council, and his name is Dick Kilburn, who's sadly no longer with us. And he always did concerts in the park. There's a great town park, so he'd bring everybody down to the town park. He'd do jazz for the older ones, he'd do pop and rock for the younger ones. And he also did a rock competition that we would all enter, like when we were like teenagers. So we were doing that, and so we were getting to play. They'd bring a name band down to the Odeon, which was the largest Odeon in England, I think, at the time. And so there'd be a Boomtown Rats or there'd be some other bands, and we would be part of the competition. So there was always something to aim for, and there was loads of recording studios around there, so we were getting really good quality demos. And Yeah, it was a very healthy scene. That the square was at the hub, but there'd be venues all over the town that we know we could be gigging three or four times a week all over it. And you meet all your musician friends, and yeah, it was a scene.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think it's one of the tragedies, or one of the many tragedies of the pandemic has definitely been the number of live music venues across the country that are sadly no longer there. It's a real blow to up-and-coming young bands that the grassroots venues are still struggling. And to hear what it was like is, you know, and it's what it could be like. So it's quite distressing, really, in some ways, definitely.
The Square was a strange one because it started off as a venue which was part of the youth part of Essex County Council. So it was getting funded by the council, but and young people could come in as we were at the time and rehearse and gig. But then it started to take over that and it became a venue in its own right, still, I think, getting funding from there. So there was this crossover where, is this a funded thing for the youth, or is this just a great, successful venue? Which it was.
Yeah, indeed. So you started off in Harlow. You've travelled the world a bit as well, though, in your career, haven't you? I mean, you played in Eddie Jordan's band for a number of years, yes. Travelling the Grand Prix circuit. I mean, is that as horrific a job as it sounds? I mean,
how we met him was there's a mutual friend of his who is a very famous producer called Chris Thomas, who first produced the Beatles when Chris Thomas... George Martin went away on holiday, Sex Pistols, Pulp, everybody, you know, Elton John, even Razorlight's hit album he did. He was friends with Eddie Jordan. So we go down there in 1994 and play on the back of a truck. And I look around at one point, there'd be Christopher Byrne, then look around and there'd be Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, everyone. And then he wanted to make it a proper band. So he did, and he financed it, and we'd travel. We'd go all over the world. I went to Australia, Hungary, Dubai, loads of Middle East places, wherever there was a Grand Prix. But also, we played festivals. We played Tea in the Park, and I brought my son there, who was in heaven, because we stayed backstage for 3 days with hotels outside it, with meal tickets, with everything, and every band my son wanted to see, like Panic at the Disco, everything was there, and we were... Kate Nash, well, I'm busy working backstage, and then Kate Nash's security came up to me and says, "Your son, well, what a guy! He was so respectful. He waited until he came out, and so we'll look after him for you." So, awesome. So we did Tea in the Park. We would do things like Deutsche Bank's Christmas parties. We played Eddie Jordan's Christmas parties, children's weddings. We'd go everywhere. I'm not a fan of the Grand Prix, so it helped that it was like every time I looked out on the crowds with all their red hats. I wish I was at Glastonbury. But it was a lovely... he was a top man, and the band... Because the band morphed from a band I was in after Roger Taylor's band called Miss World. Again, it's produced by Chris Thomas and Dave Stewart, because on Dave Stewart's record label from Eurythmics. Okay. I never travelled to America with The Cross, but with them, my first tour of America was with Miss World. So that was also taking me here, there and everywhere, which then became... the focus of the Grand Prix band.
Right, okay.
So it was a tough life.
Yeah, it sounds it. I mean, you've mentioned it a couple of times now. So Roger Taylor, the drummer of Queen, he quite a while ago now went on to form The Cross, where he was lead guitarist and lead singer, and you were the bassist in there. Yeah, I mean, how did that come about, and how was that part of your adventure? I mean, that's...
Well, that's a major part of my adventure as a young man, because... two ways I got into that band. I got in that by, I sent stuff off by the Melody Makers. It was still in existence then as a music paper. I also had a woman looking after me, and she sent my details. So it came from two sides. And
okay.
It was an audition process. And from that moment on, from the moment I got it, it changed my life, really, because I was still living at home with my parents. And suddenly I was... Like 2 weeks after we joined the band, he took us to Ibiza for 3 weeks. We rehearsed there. We'd go out to the clubs. We had a right old rare time. And he wanted straight away, he went, "This is a real band. This isn't you guys backing me. I want you to write." And he also did something which was a bit of hard for everyone involved, which was, "I only want to do TV shows which are live. I won't do any miming on a TV show." So every time we did a TV show in that initial beginning of the band, we had to do a live performance of whatever song.
Wow. And that was quite unusual back then, wasn't it? I mean,
very unusual. Now it's not, but then it was very unusual. And obviously, because it was him, they went, "Okay." But he was a top man, and Spike Edney was also in it, who's still the Queen keyboard player. And it was three new guys, me, Clayton Moss in those days, and Josh McRae, who still works with Roger as his co-producer and engineer and runs the studios. It was like walking into a different world, because obviously Freddie Mercury was still alive then. My parents witnessed all the TV shows I was on and different things. And it was just, it took it to another level. And because it was just the same as what I was been doing from bands in Harlow and other things, I just ventured into London. It was like, it was, oh, okay, so we can write songs with you. We can write songs, yeah. So it was an experience when which you didn't feel, oh, I'm just backing this rock star.
Yeah.
We are part of it. And so it was, and we did three albums in 5 years. So it was a 5-year period.
I think it's all on Spotify and things like that. And there's tracks. Yeah, there's as you say, you co-wrote a lot of the tracks. There's a couple that you wrote, you've got solo writing credits on, and there's all sorts there. And
yeah.
So yeah.
And I think one last thing, which when I when we did a reunion in 2013, it just coincidence that he was getting his thing called Roger Taylor the Lot, and it was all his solo stuff, which incorporated the three albums. It was a box set. And in that box set, it was every video we ever made, every album, but also stuff that I'd forgotten about, the demos we'd made. They correlated everything and put it on there. So it was like, yeah, it was, you know, and obviously we got one each. So that was nice.
Yeah. Who are your musical heroes? When we've spoken in the past, you've said some, and I know that your love of music is all encompassing. I mean, there's the, yeah, you love music. And,
I do. I do it. Yeah.
But who would you say your musical heroes are?
My musical hero, it's quite, well, it's from you, really young. It was one thing which was mine, and then mostly my oldest brother, who sadly passed away last year's record collection. So for me, I got on my own. I got the Beatles on my own in the 70s. So for me, it was John Lennon growing up. Yeah. And now, and Mac, and all of them, George, all of it, all of them. Mm. Because it was, I didn't know why I loved it so much. Even when I became a musician, I didn't want to work out their songs. I just loved the magic of it, and learning and knowing that them, because they started like nearly as teenagers and went to Hamburg. It's like, well, we were teenagers. It was like, oh God, you can be in a band from your youth and with your mates, and something can happen. So my first band was with my brother, but so that was massive. And seeing them move through all periods of the 60s. But as a bass player, reggae, massive amounts of reggae was it. And I love reggae. And I've got a reggae track on my album, which I didn't play it until I listened to reggae for a month and just was jamming it to see, I'm white from Essex, I need to become from Jamaica. And so the reggae influence on my life was massive. Bob Marley, all the reggae greats, but his bass player, two bass players, Robbie Shakespeare and Family Man Barrett from Bob Marley's band.
Right.
But then also Phil Lynott as a bass player and a songwriter. Paul Simonon for how cool he looked back in the day. That meant a lot. But then leaping forward to dance music, that was the next bit in my life which went, because there's dance stuff on my album, which was a massive influence, which was, I was a rock musician. We were in Ibiza with Roger Taylor when the dancing is meant to have begun, way back in 87.
Okay.
And it did. It was. We were at all those clubs. And it was all, and all the DJs came back. But then by the late 80s into the 90s, bands like massive influence on me, who we knew, called Underworld, and we knew them as Fur.
Yeah.
And we'd go and see them at the Marquee. And so we would actually hang out with them. And my friend who loved them, did t-shirts for them. But when they became Underworld, that my friend, their first album, Dub in My Head with No Bass Man, my friend said, this is the Sgt. Pepper of dance music, and I still believe it, and I believe him. And so the sequence stuff of dance music blew my mind, and at first I didn't get it. I got it, but I didn't know, where's the first chorus, where's the next bit?
Yeah.
Until I went out raving, and then I got it, and I went, this is life-changing. So that was a massive influence on me, and still is. Because when I hear my stuff now, you saying, why did it take so long? When I was listening to how do they do it? How do they make these sequences? Wow, I can play. And then my friends got, when they started showing me, this is my home computer and here's a music program, here's a bit of information and I can loop it. Wow. So that was a massive influence.
Changed everything.
changed everything.
So yeah, tell me about the album then. As you said, we've talked about the fact that it took, the gestation period was quite some time. But yeah, tell me about it.
It's new artist. So I did the dance one in 2014, and then because I've been working with other people like Peter Bruntnell and doing his albums, then it became, I want to do mine. And so I know there's going to be a dance element. I know I'm going to use lots of real instruments, and I know there's going to be, it's going to feature the bass because that's my first job and who I am. But obviously I want it to be songs, not boring, just about that, those things. And so I started writing knowing that I wanted dance elements, I wanted to get a reggae stuff in there, and I wanted songs which people liked, or I liked initially. And so that was my rules. There'd be technology, there'd be live instruments, my voice, and songwriting. But I'll also want to make some of the songs over dance pieces, which don't necessarily change chord, or they change chord minimally. And so there's one on the album called In the Water, which is about my love of swimming. And what I've realised, I thought, I'm a better lyricist than I thought I was, because I write this stuff, and after listening to it multiple times, and I've been working on it for like 3 years, I don't think it's rubbish. And it communicates what I do. So that was the influence. And so then it came into the writing of the songs. And I probably wrote that. I mean, it's a long album. It's going to be a double album, really, because I need to get all this stuff out. Because as George Harrison once said, if I don't get it out, I won't be able to do new stuff. So that went into, I wanted the dance ones, which I've got. I wanted to write reggae, which I'm really pleased. And some pop songs on it as well. And I've got a few guests on there as well. I've got James Warburton playing guitar. I've got one song called, which is the only Beatle-influenced one, called Cut in Three. But I've got my friend James Warburton, who's a guitar player with the Pretenders. He's played a guitar, and he's only got his own band called His Lordship, who are rocking and rolling at the moment. And and he played an amazing guitar solo on it for me. And my brother's played some great guitar on it as well. But mostly it's all me playing it. But then I got my brother sort of said, could you master these songs? And he said, yeah, I'll have a go. And he mastered it. And then he said, can I mix one for you? So he mixed one. I said, that's great, Matt. I love what you do. Could you try mixing all of them? Which was obviously 15 songs. And so it's taken it, which I've literally written this morning, written to him the last notes of some changes of what I want him to do. And then it will be done. And he mixed all 15 of them. I'm only using 14 of them. And we've done it all over the internet because he's in France and I'm here. So it's been a kind of slow process.
Plans to, if possible, play it live or some of it? What can be played live?
Well, first of all, what I've done is acoustically, I've worked out what and practiced and rehearsed myself. What can I do if I had to do it acoustically?
Right, okay.
Because it's electronic as well as songs, but it's very much sounds like each song's a production number on the album. So that's the first thing I've done. I've told my brother, even I'm not sure because he's in France, I said, I'm going to France in thingy, learn the songs so we can play them together, Martin. Because I can't remember what I played. I said, well, you better remember. So he's got to do that. And but yes, I'm going to do it live. But I understand, I'd love to get a bit more feedback on that, because obviously then what I need for my live band is drummer, even though I've got loop pedals I can use on it, bass player. I will jump around between bass, guitar, keyboards, somebody does backing singers and plays keys and technology, percussionist, guitarist.
Right, okay.
So it'll be a lineup to reproduce this stuff. So yes, I hear it and go yes, but I also, because I've got so much experience of people running bands, it's like that's the next hurdle for me to go, okay, doing that. If because the greatest thing is in earth is to have lots of money where you can go, I'll pay you for that, and people go okay. But if you encourage them to do it for the love of it, but only paying a bit, you've got to get a real commitment going.
Yeah, it's got to be the people that are doing it because they love what you've done, rather
exactly.
Than,
but yes, I want to be my own band leader because I've been in other bands. I've been the subordinate for too long.
Yeah, you want to be giving the orders. Brilliant. And I mean, that's the other thing. You are still in a number of other bands at the moment, and you've got quite a lot of other things. Pete Brantel, you mentioned. John Moss, you mentioned you're in a band with him. Ridiculous. I mean, it's...
And I was still doing that. Ridiculous. Yeah, we just released a single. Well, a video and a single. I don't know if you've seen it, Gareth, which has just come onto Facebook, which is called Everybody Loves That Girl. And that's that. And in that band, we have John on drums. We have me on bass, Aaron Baron Cohen, who's Sacha Baron Cohen's brother on keyboards, and Sebastian Walker, who's lead singer and most of the songs. Even I play one of the songs on my album in that set. And it's all very harmony led and got 60s vibe to it, that one. And Peter Bruntall, I've been playing with Peter Bruntall for over 20 years, and I think he's probably the greatest singer-songwriter in this country, if he was acknowledged as that. And he's gone from having major deals to doing it himself to actually producing it all himself. And he's become really good at making his own records, as everyone has to practically these days, if you can't get all these mass advances or thousands of pounds.
Yeah. And the landscape has changed with that.
Landscape has changed. When I was very, very young doing it, we walked into studios like Townhouse, Olympic was still there. These huge studios, it's evolved from the 60s, 70s, 80s into the 90s. And now everyone's doing it in their own homes, which is in some ways egalitarian that everyone's got the thing. But sometimes I remember walking into record companies and you just went, how many people? All doing the press department, thing department. And it was like, wow, you know. It was the golden age, and the end of that golden age came when with file sharing, when the old music business didn't see that people aren't going to pay for it in the same way ever again.
Right, sir. Thank you very much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. We're going to finish this off now. We're going to play To Laugh or Cry, which is going to be the next single from the album, I believe. Yes. Tell us about that.
Funny enough, To Laugh or Cry musically started the same thing where my friend was going to take back the keyboard and I went, I better write a tune. So I wrote the chords and then wrote a song around the chords. And as it came out, it was in the heart of lockdown. And even though I was talking to my friends saying, we can't write a song about lockdown now. It would just be too much. We're living it. But then I thought, oh, I've written one, but that was a year ago. So it was at my feelings of what was going on and living through it really, as we've all done. I mean, and what I did early on, I started running and then I thought, I don't want to do that. And I got a bike and I started a bike. So there's a line about being on my bike in the song. And I literally would just go out every morning just to get some exercise and just experience that. But it was also how it made me feel about the whole experience and how it was being managed. And when the world shuts down and how you internalize and what you feel about it. And so And when I wrote those words, it was about, that's how I feel about it now. And my wife was going through some sort of major stuff as well. So that got in there as well. So it's where I was during 20 and 21, I suppose.
Right. Okay. So this is Peter Angnoon, To Laugh or Cry. Thank you very much for chatting to us today. When I post the interview up online, I'll put some links to your social media so people can keep an eye out for news on the album and any live dates and everything, and put some links to the other stuff. But yeah, brilliant talking to you.
Great. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you very much. Be in vain.
your shopping trolley full to the brim tonight, for time is tight. I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I still believe in love and life tonight, tonight. We all have a choice to make, to see it all, some music's fake. Alright, it's not alright.
Like time itself.